lots of fantastic books out there from from PMI, Agile Business Consortium in particular, around agile project and program and portfolio management. But even they focus mostly on IT enabled stuff. And I just wanted to get away from that and say, let's look and see what any project might look like if you apply agility to it. And to my mind then, once you've done that, you can say, you can use that as a model for building an organization that's friendly to projects. Other models are available, but here's one.
Yeah.
And I think it works.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that first part of that interview with Adrian. And he'll be back next week. So have a great week and speak soon. Bye. So what's been going on last week or so, or a couple of weeks? Busy old time as usual, managed to get a bit of moving around. But I think a highlight of the week so far, or the fortnight, has been the message that I'm just about to play you now.
Thank you so much, Nigel. This is Naveen from India. Your efforts are highly helpful for project managers throughout the world. Thank you so much.
So thank you very much, Naveen, for that message. It's always good to hear from people when they're listening to the show, to find out that you're finding of use and of interest. And if anyone else wants to do it, there's if you jump onto the Anchor site or through the Anchor feed, you can leave me a message and I will play it on the show, as long as it's not too offensive. Or if you've got questions or queries or thoughts or just anything really, just drop me a message and we'll see. Maybe start the conversation a little bit more two-way going forward. I've had a few interviews that I've been working through this last few weeks. A few have fallen through and a few have happened. So it's really good. The ones I have got nailed in will be out fairly soon. Just get them all tidied up. We've got enough shows. We've got a couple. We've got Drew Jennison coming up later on in the year. Mike Schlegel as well. And then kicking off next year with Gregory Offner and Lucy Harrison. And those are the ones that are in the bag at the moment. So keep an eye out for when those pop into your subscription. I think that's kind of everything that's really important that's been going on from my perspective. And I think I'm just going to let you get on and have a listen to Adrian Pine and my conversation with him about being agile and not just with an IT project. Have fun. Bye. So today I'm absolutely delighted to welcome Adrian Pine to the show. Adrian is the author of this book, Agile Beyond IT. Sorry, I've got it too close to me screen. There we go. It says on the back of it, so it must be true. He's a project professional for over 30 years, has led changes in 11 industries in the public sector in the UK and abroad. The author of books on program management and agile governance and assurance. He has contributed to the evolution of program, portfolio and PMO standards and is a regular speaker, visiting lecturer, blogger and researcher. Welcome to the show, Adrian.
Thank you very much. What a glowing tribute there. My goodness. I could have written it myself.
It does. I doubt you could have done better yourself. Yeah, you're absolutely right. I think it's amazing how these bios are really good for people. And as you say, it's printed on the back of a book, so it must be true. Tell us a little bit more about you. Beyond that, where you're from? People will probably guess from your accent where you're from, but
well,
from a country point of view.
kind of country point of view, yeah, I'm from England. I grew up in on the edge of southeast London, or as it probably should have been, southeast London. But I think my parents made sure my brother and I never spoke like that. So you know, there we go.
Right.
These days though, I live in Dorset, in a very nice little village.
Beautiful.
West Dorset, so which is really, really nice. There's my partner of nearly 31 years, who's a retired architect, and both he and I love gardening. So we've got a very big garden and a bit of a field, and planted a few hundred trees over the last sort of 10, 11 years. And we've got loads of fantastic walks, and we like going off on holidays to sort of do walking in sort of Wales or various other places around the UK. I think both of us not doing, COVID or no, not doing a great deal in terms of foreign travel, because both of us have spent quite a lot of our professional lives traveling in various places around the world. So my partner's built buildings in sort of Saudi Arabia to bits of Europe and all over the UK, and I've worked in various places around the world, in the States and everything. So, you know, these days we prefer to, at least at the moment, staying a bit closer to home, and love touring around the UK.
Well, I'm very fortunate. I live just on the Welsh border, up on the north of Wales in Shropshire, and as you say, for me, it's an hour's drive to go to different parts of Wales. It's astounding. Where you live down there in that area is astounding. And this country has got so much to give, especially if you want to go outdoors and stuff. It's just an astounding place. And it's funny when you say that about the travelling and stuff. I remember, I've not been a very much of an international traveller, but I remember a similar sort of thing that when I was working for Oracle a few years back, where I was a consultant project manager, so I was traveling a lot. Most days I was away or staying in London, staying in hotels and doing that sort of thing. And then I'd kind of go away with my other half, and we'd go to a hotel for a weekend, and I'm sitting there thinking, I don't want another frigging Caesar salad, to be quite honest.
I know what you mean.
I do like a Caesar salad.
There you are. We were actually just outside Oswestry only about 2 or 3 weeks ago.
So that's where I live.
There you go. So do you know the Penydifferin?
The Penydifferin. Yes. Yes.
So,
yeah. 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 Been there. I can't remember whose
really
birthday.
Fantastic walking. Yeah.
Well, I live in a little village called Pant, which is on its way out into Wales. So you're heading out towards Welshpool along the A483. So yeah, you were literally in spitting distance from my house then. There you go. Well, that's good. I love this area. Born and bred here, and I stay here. So
I started out, one of the first, I guess, bits of business travel I ever had to do, because I started out in BT. Back in 86, and in the very, very early days of quite primitive networks, I started out in IT and BT, and I had to come up to, BT had a big and slightly secret place in Oswestry, had a control centre in Oswestry.
Park Hall, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's right, and it had some subterranean levels, which were, at least I was told whether it's true or not, because it's no longer there. It was sort of a emergency control center if the bomb ever dropped. So there were sort of buttons on the lift that you had to have a lock and a code in order to be able to operate.
Wow.
And they never let me down there. Sensible people.
You're sure it just wasn't fancy toilets or anything like that?
I don't know. I mean, they could have been just putting my leg, but there were. I think they're about -4 levels. I was like, okay, this is interesting.
Yeah, it wouldn't surprise me, because obviously Park Hall Camp there, and we're going back at history of Oswestry there, this would change this podcast too now. Park Hall Camp, where that building was an army barracks for many, many years, military army barracks. My dad was based there and ended up staying around this area, so back in the Second World War. So there's a lot of stuff going on there. And then when you look over towards Welshpool, towards Criggan, there was a radio telescope that's not a radio telescope, a radio antenna that was for the Polaris submarines, was either redundancy or the major communication. So it makes sense that you might have some of that stuff in and around the area. So for anyone who wants to come to Shropshire, you can. It's a lovely place, and Oldchester is amazing as well. So
yeah.
So we're not going to talk about that. Yeah, we're not going to talk about it. It's been interesting though that working with BT, because obviously IT within BT and our conversation today, a bit off the back of your book, but actually I kind of want to go back a little bit before that, a little bit, and say. And here's a question. I hope it won't be too bad. Agile is a emotive subject. In many fields, it's the one topic that when I look on LinkedIn, I can see quite a few diverse opinions, and I have some joy watching them sometimes, and occasionally chip in what I think. Not that I'm utterly qualified for it, but I have an opinion. So let's start with what I think is probably a key thing. What is Agile?
I'm kind of with another Adrian on this one, first of all. I prefer to try and use the word agility rather than Agile.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause and it's not just a bit of semantics, it's trying to get away from the almost religious discussion and attitudes that some people have around Agile with a big A. And some folk, especially from kind of an IT background, can get rather protective of Agile and say, you can't, you know, it came out of software, Agile Manifesto, can't do anything else with it. And if you try and do it, you're a heretic and we should burn you at the stake. And stuff, and then there's other folk that have say, I take Agile, and they say I'm being Agile in my organization. And 10 or 11, 12 years ago, I started to say, well, what do you mean? Because I get the Agile Manifesto, and which I personally think is the most coherent definition or description of what agility means. And yeah, you can kind of boil it down into being, it means flexibility and it means doing just enough of something. And as in fact, I wrote in response to a bit of a someone's blog today, and I was agreeing with something they were saying. I said, just enough doesn't mean leaving stuff out. It means you do just enough. It's like, great tennis players, people, you know, from in the kind of era that I used to sort of still playing a bit of tennis, sort of Bjorn Borg or the great players of today, Nadal, they don't move around the tennis court any more than they need to. Their job is to make the other person move around and stuff. And so, you know, so they don't play more tennis than they absolutely have to. And to me, that's kind of, when I started looking at the Agile Manifesto years ago, and I thought to myself, well, hang on a second, if I take away the pure IT bit of this, or take it out of an IT context, this describes how I work. You know, I'm always focusing on value, and most great project professionals focus on value, which is, I've got to say, it's different from when I started out in projects back in the 80s, back into the late-ish 80s. And then all the training courses said, projects are about producing stuff. You do stuff with them. You start, and it has the usual sort of time, cost, quality, however you want to define the three parameters.
Yeah.
But they're there to produce stuff. And that never sat right with me way, way back then. I thought, well, hang on a second. Well, yes, projects produce stuff, but why do they produce stuff? And the answer is that, to actually get some benefit out of it. And that's where I started coming from. When I first was in the mid 90s, and I was starting to work as a consultant, and putting together project management capabilities in organizations, I started from the standpoint of why are we doing projects? And what do we need to get out of the projects? And that's how we measure whether a project is successful or not. Is it delivering some kind of benefit? Is it delivering some kind of value? So the whole value basis of agility, which is absolutely at its core, is great for me. It's not new. It's another reason why I like to use the word agility, because agility has been with us an awful long time. I recognize not just myself, but a lot of other professionals of my advanced age, sort of around, you know, retirement and gone retirement, as having exhibited agility for decades, even before someone wrote down and said what agility actually looked for. So way before 2001. And so it's been with us a long time. It just so happens that a group of amazing people sat down and came up with the Agile Manifesto. And then you can take the Agile Manifesto, which was absolutely about developing software. And I realized, again, 10, 11, 12 years ago, well, actually, you can take this and you can apply it in other areas, which lots of people have done. And it's been applied in marketing and engineering, product development, well beyond the software, and even construction, and of course, project management. I've even seen and written a report about an agile nuclear engineering program, or put it another way, a nuclear engineering program that was done in an agile way. And they didn't know it at the time. They said, come and do a review of this program. And I did. And I said, do you realize how you've gone about running this and the freedom you've been given to come up with the solutions, some really tricky technical solutions to a huge engineering, nuclear engineering problem that they were dealing with. And they were the only people in the world who could actually tackle that problem. So they were given the authority to actually come up with solutions with people looking over their shoulder, but that's fine, but not people on their shoulder and on their back all the time. It was a classic piece of agile behavior, not just in the team, but from the organizational landscape and the around them. And, you know, and I talk to people and I say, oh yeah, agile nuclear engineering. And they go, no, you cannot possibly do nuclear engineering agile. Well, there you go, there's one.
So, it's funny because...
There's a rambling answer for you, yeah. What is agility? Focus on value, flexibility, and doing just enough.
Which is really easy to think about, isn't it? And I think the pseudo religious behaviours of some, or some, maybe it's not a behaviour, it's some of the things that, and I might have been a little bit guilty, having done my Scrum Master course of getting really annoyed with people who are saying we're agile, and then I sit there going, but you're not doing this and you're not doing that, so therefore you are not. And it kind of, in recent months or years, I've kind of sat there and gone, well, actually, isn't that you've got those core fundamentals that you're talking about there, and actually the tools that you use, or the methodology, in quotes, that you use. I suppose the thing is, it's like Scrum. If you're not doing stand-ups, are you doing Scrum? Well, you can still be agile, but not be doing... And it's about using those tools to support it in a way that suits what you need, and being agile in how you use those tools. And it's kind of sit there and go, right, we're using a Kanban board, brilliant, superb, right, it's not working for us because we've done a retrospective, we've worked out that using that Kanban board isn't working because what we're trying to do at the moment doesn't lend itself. We haven't broken it down to enough tasks for us to be, so how do we do it differently? But that doesn't necessarily mean you're not using agility to do that. In fact, you're using agility to re-engineer that, I think. And I think I mentioned to you earlier, I've seen it with, I've tried to use, what I describe as not being agile, but I've seen things where people put things, oh, we're going to deliver this in an agile framework with capital A. And I've kind of changed it, say, no, we're going to use agile methodologies or agile techniques to deliver it, which is what's really happening in, from what I'm seeing in there. And it's kind of, but again, even then, sometimes I'm being a bit picky and pedantic because as it's, I suppose it's the capital and the little A, which is the bit that draws the question.
I'm not so sure you are being sort of picky and pedantic because, you know, it is a kind of key question. Can you be a bit agile? And I mean, the simple answer is yes. And I've seen loads of examples of projects and, or, well, sometimes not projects, sometimes just software developments, or sometimes projects, sometimes other things, where they say, you know, we're using agility. And I'm thinking, when I look at how they're working, and I'm thinking, well, you're using a bit of agility. And the answer is, yeah, you can get some value out of that. But the whole point is, with the set of the Agile principles, for the Agile manifesto and the four values, is that you get the value, you get the highest and greatest value out of applying all of those values and all of those principles. And another thing which I've seen, which is also probably true, there probably is a tipping point where you're not being enough agile to get any value at all. And in fact, you start getting anti-agile. And I've certainly taken part in a lot of, I don't know, shall we say, blog discussions where people say, oh, you've got anti-patterns going on, anti-agile going on. And that is true. When someone says, I guess the best example of that, or most common I think I've seen, is where teams are trying to do agility inside a team, inside a project, and everything in the organizational landscape around it is killing it. So an agile team is supposed to basically have all the people in the team it needs, the right subject matter experts, the right technical people, da-da-da-da-da. If you simply have got a team where the organization is refusing to give the right, the subject matter experts, for example, with the right capability, and even if it does, not empowering those to make the decision, even though they've got all the knowledge and experience they need, then you're killing the agility. Because the whole point of agility is to do things faster and deliver value faster. That's really what it kind of boils down to. The idea is, you can still, in lots of other techniques with waterfall software development approaches, you can still deliver value. Can you deliver it faster? And the big attraction that, in fact, I think it says so on the Agile Manifesto pages, is that we're about delivering working software faster. I think that's one of the key, one of the big drivers for them. And so if you do it properly, you can potentially get that benefit, probably more often than not. So there does come a point where if someone's being only a bit agile, then in the areas that they're not being a bit agile, how damaging, how anti-agile are those areas? And it kind of brings me into another area which I recognize around projects. Now, something that I kind of observed probably 25 years ago is, and it's something which actually still only very recently has been reflected in what people would call good practice or best practice. So writings by the PMI, APM and the like. And that is that projects have always been written about as being successful because of what goes on inside the project or the program or the portfolio. And that is, of course, true. But there's another dimension, and that is the organizational environment, the hinterland around the project. And again, it's an example like I just gave. The number of times as a project professional myself, I've had to go battling to get resources that have been promised when the project's in mobilization and they just never materialize, or people who are just not experienced enough, or simply not getting, although the funding is promised, it that never materializes, or it's not enough, or it gets slowed down. And half the time, a project manager can find themselves battling against the organization to keep their project alive, let alone successful. So you've got a two-dimensional thing here. On the one hand, projects are successful or not because of what goes on inside them and the effectiveness of the team, its leadership, etc. But also, the environment around the project, its hinterland, is the other dimension. And unfortunately, in most organizations, projects are like viruses. They're tacked on. They're not business as usual. And because of that very nature, they're not business as usual, so they don't get the attention. Part of that is, and you know, we could be opening up massive cans of worms here, but I'll say why it's particularly important for agility, is because at board level, most people on boards don't get projects because they don't come from a projects background. They come from a BAU background. They are accountants, they're lawyers, they're engineers, they're techie people, they're whatever, they're marketing people, whatever they happen to be. And there's nothing wrong with that or their experience whatsoever. But in these days of increasing projectization, and PMI have written and produced huge evidence about the increasing projectization of work, projects are moving more and more into the operation. They're moving more and more into the business as usual. If you've got leadership at the top of the organization that doesn't understand 50% of what the organization does, that's a recipe for waste, for a huge amount of wasted investment. So why that's important,
I was going to say, it boils to that. As a project manager that's always sat there, that project sponsorship, that project support for each project, and proper project sponsorship. Because one of the things I've read before now is around having sponsors, when you have a project sponsor, and I didn't get a chance to put it about one bit of advice to give a project sponsor on Jonathan Norman's Opiner the other day would have been, I was going to do it and I forgot to register, but the thought I had was actually get trained in understanding projects as a project sponsor, so you understand where your role fits and how you fit in with that project manager. And as you say, those BAU people, understanding what's expected of them, understanding what, and being available for that project manager is a bit that, as you say, that causes these, a massive, again, it kind of rings me back to, I've been reading Tammy Watchorn's book, one of your fellow stable authors, and just the things is she talks about getting stuff done despite the organisation, really, in her book, from the way I'm reading it. And I think that is what we do find ourselves sometimes, isn't it? It's because you know this is the right thing to do, you know it needs to be done, and everyone wants you to do it, but no one's acting as if they do. And it just, that sponsorship, real sponsorship, not I'm the SRO, I'm the project sponsor, yes, I'm the one who signs the checks, and then that's it. There's so much more that's needed from them.
Absolutely, and quite often project professionals will find themselves negotiating with the senior manager who is the project sponsor, who is the SRO, for how much of their time they're going to have. Interestingly enough, several years ago, I was asked to go and do some work with the top management team of a particular business school. And they said, we're having problems because all of us in the top management team, we are all sponsors for particular change projects in and around the business school. And we're challenged in that role. And so I went in and did some discussion with them collectively and individuals, and it soon became clear that, not surprisingly, as very senior people in a very good business school, they knew exactly up there what an SRO role was about, a sponsorship role about. They absolutely got that. They absolutely understood that. What they didn't have was the time to do it because they had incredibly busy day jobs. So actually, we turned it round. And the piece of work I did with them was working out, not for, if you like, that financial year, because they were just on a treadmill and couldn't change it. It says, right, for the future years, this, let's work out a way that gives you collectively and individually the space to do your, let's say, business as usual roles and your projects and your project facing roles. And that's what that piece of work ended up all about. And that apparently seemed to work very, very well, certainly the next year. And after that, I wasn't involved any more. So seemed to be okay. And so they had to actually find a way of changing their, almost their business as usual, because they were having to speak. They could no longer tenably have projects as something they fitted in to 5 minutes a day, which was crazy thing to do, but far too important to the business school. So they actually had to be somehow fitted into the operation. Let's not call it the business as usual, let's call it the operation. So projects as part of the operation. And that's increasingly where I'm from these days.
Yeah, because it's interesting, because I recently did a bit of refresher training on strategy, and it's something I've been looking at and as an area that I need to, because I've always thought that I do think ahead, and in my role I try to look beyond the next delivery sort of thing and generally managing teams of people. And it makes me wonder whether actually you've got strategy, which is these leaders in those organizations, that's where you really want them spending a lot of their time thinking about the way down the future for their particular area of expertise, those lawyers, those accountants, those marketing people. And then the next part of their role is as you say, is the operations, actually keeping things going. But the bit that sits in the middle that takes us from strategy and then puts it into operation is projects, isn't it? Projects is the realization of the strategy into the operational environment.
Well, it's what projects, if you in the modern kind of era, were invented for. And that is, and it's also why program management evolved really in the early 1990s, because the size and complexity and the frequency of change was increasing and increasing and increasing, and project management couldn't cope. It simply couldn't cope with the complexity of stuff that was being thrown in its direction, which is why program management evolved. And then the sheer frequency and numbers of change initiatives, you then had to gather those together, which is really where portfolio management emerged. And I was, back in the day with the late and much lamented or missed guru of program management, Jeff Rees. He led ProgM, which was APM's program management SIG. And for many years, as well as program management, because all these other ideas were floating around, ProgM flew the flag for portfolio management and PMO, the development of understanding of PMOs within APM, until other people came along and said, we need to actually, develop this much, much further. And they took it on, and there were separate SIGs, and which is fantastic. That's exactly what needed to happen. So, but you had that clear evolution path in response to what was happening. But now we've got this thing where, as I say, you've got projects increasingly moving into the operation. And that's different from what I saw happening 20 years ago, 30 years ago. And that has absolutely far more impact on an organization than, shall we say, change projects and programs, you know, which which have arguably been peripheral for many, many years, if not decades. So given that, and that's another thing which piqued my interest in agility, because I started to see that because agility is 50% agile, 50% behavioral, and or roughly, it's hard, you know, it's as much behavioral as it is process. And that again is pretty much unlike anything, any other aspect of method that I've used over the years. In fact, the people side of project management didn't even really start to emerge until well into the 1990s with the APM body of knowledge. You didn't get much in the way of the behavioral stuff in PMI bodies of knowledge until the 2000s and stuff. But, you know, PMI are on the ball these days, far, far more with that stuff. And a leading in many ways. But it wasn't there then. And so with the organizational dimension of it, which PMI have written a lot about and researched a lot about, and APM as well, you've got to say, well, okay, so how do you create an organization that is supportive of projects? And to me, agility is a model for that, because it's got all the principles and the values for that. It's got the behavioral stuff, it's got the process side of it. It's got all those principles and values already built in. What needed to happen, and this is why what drove me to write the book really, was nobody, to my mind, had really stepped back and said, let's forget about IT projects, forget about IT. What does agility itself look like when applied to the whole of project management, not just inside a project, but also the organizational side of it? I was sitting around the project. How do you make projects thrive? And that to me was the key differentiator. Lots of fantastic books out there from PMI, Agile Business Consortium in particular, around agile project and program and portfolio management. But even they focus mostly on IT-enabled stuff. And I just wanted to get away from that and say, let's look and see what any project might look like if you apply agility to it. And to my mind then, once you've done that, you can say, you can use that as a model for building an organization that's friendly to projects. Other models are available, but here's one, and I think it works.
Hi, and welcome to the Sunday Lunch Project Manager podcast for Sunday, the 13th of November, 2022. This is your host, Nigel Creaser. And today I meet Adrian Pine, the Agile Beyond IT guy. Speak to you soon. Wow, you made it this far. I'm guessing that you enjoyed the show if you have. Or maybe you've just left it playing in the background and forgot it was on. But if you did enjoy it, and you're inclined to, I'd be delighted if you could share the show with your colleagues. It's discoverability with podcasts is quite difficult, especially with a niche one like this. But sharing with your colleagues and letting them have a chance to listen to these fantastic guests would be brilliant. If you've got time, a review on whatever platform you listen to it on would be great too, especially if it's a 5-star one. Again, that makes it easier for people to discover the show when they're searching on there, because comments raise it up the old search engine, ups and optimization on all the different tools. If you are feeling flush, I have a couple of ways you could contribute. One is Patreon, patreon.com/SundayLunchPM, and you can donate some money to the podcast that way, or you can jump along to my website, nigelcreaser.com, www.nigelcreaser.com, and click on the link to the shop. And in there, you've got all my books that I've created in the varying different guises, a number of different ways you can grab a copy of those. And down the bottom, I've got the my guests' books. So everyone who's been on here, if they've had a book, I've got a link to their book in there, and Amazon give me a little bit back for when someone buys from them. But more importantly, if you come back next time and listen, I'll be delighted. So I'll leave you alone and let you get on with your day now. Thank you. Bye.